Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, and this is a half an hour journey through culinary history. And today, we have with us Jana Gore. Jana is the founder and editor-in-chief of the leading Israeli food and wine magazine, On the Table. And she's the author of a book called The Book of New Israeli Food, A Culinary Journey. So we're having two journeys here, a journey through culinary history and a culinary journey through Israeli food. She lives in, actually, Jana was born and raised in the former Soviet Union before immigrating to Israel, and she now lives in Tel Aviv on Israel's Mediterranean coast, of course. And we're very welcome to have her here. Welcome, Jana.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
We, here in New York, we are having a downpour, and but we're sitting in our nice dry studio, and we're going to pretend that we're on the sunny Mediterranean coast, okay? And what I have to say about this book is that I was talking to Jana before we went on the air, and I had not eaten before I looked at it the first time. I don't recommend you do that. I recommend that anyone who looks at this book, again, the Book of New Israeli Food, it is so gorgeous to look at. The photographs in it. And who the photographer again was?
Photographer is Elon Paz, and he's actually based in New York.
Brooklyn, right? It is just a gorgeous book to look at. The pictures. It's really not only does it belong on your shelf of cookbooks, but it belongs on your coffee table. I mean, it is a coffee table book.
I know
as
that
well as a
for American public, it's even a little bit confusing. They say, well, this book doesn't know whether it's cookbook or coffee table book. I think it's good that the book has lots of gorgeous pictures.
But what I was going to add is it is as wonderful and delicious to cook from as it is to look at for the gorgeous pictures. So it really does serve a dual purpose. It's very good in that way. And so I'm thinking, well, okay, we have the Book of New Israeli Food, but we can't really understand new Israeli food unless we know about old Israeli food and the past in history, since this is a show about culinary history. So what I would like you to do is sort of take us first on a little journey through the past, where Israeli food, I mean, first of all, when people think of Israeli food, they think, of course, immediately of just Jewish food, which it is, but
it is
so
also
much more.
Jewish food,
but
it's so much more.
Yeah.
It is Jewish food. It is Jewish food in a way that it is part of Jewish food history. And Jews have fascinating history, and they have fascinating food history. I'll need a week to explain all that. I'll try to do it.
There's so many different
foods.
Okay,
yes. And basically, you know, Israel, Jewish history, like in 2 minutes, we're living in the land of Israel, you know, many thousand years ago, very basic agricultural society, and we were more or less exiled from Israel about, depending when, certain groups of Jews left Israel, or Israelites left Israel, the land of Israel, even earlier in the time of Babel, in the destruction of the first temple 2,500 years ago. But most of the Jews left the land of Israel about 2,000 years ago, and they went on and settled all over the world, basically. And this is where Jewish food history starts, because wherever Jews settled, they created their own food system. They had to, because, as you know, according to Jewish religion is very heavily based on, defined actually, Jews are defined by what they eat or do not eat, and how they eat it, and how they combine the foods. And it's not just that they wouldn't eat meat with dairy, but the meat has to be slaughtered in a certain way. And so, and interestingly, in the Bible, the kashrut laws are outlined in the Bible, but as you progress throughout the diaspora, they become more and more strict and elaborate. The utensils has to be kosher, the whole kitchen has to be kosher. And there is a theory, and I believe it's true, that the reason the kosher laws became progressively more and more strict was because it was such an effective tool to keep Jews together and separate from their neighbors.
Interesting.
Okay, and so, in order to survive, you had to stick with other Jews. You had to eat with other Jews. And so, and imagine you live in a country and there is a cuisine around you. You know about it, but you cannot touch the food. It's like looking in the, you know, through the window shop. Mm-hmm. And I know examples of that till that very day. For example, observing Jewish chefs who cannot touch non-kosher food and sometimes are not exactly aware of the trends that go on. And they operate in a certain kind of vacuum. And so that's why wherever Jews lived, they created cuisines that were simultaneously similar and different from their of their neighbors. Sometimes completely different. For example, Iraqi Jewish cuisine is completely different from Iraqi non-Jewish or Iraqi Muslim cuisine, and much more similar to Persian cuisine. In other cases, for example, Moroccan cuisine is quite similar to that of the non-Jewish Moroccan. Ashkenazi cuisine, which is generally recognized as Jewish cuisine, but it is of course only one kind of Jewish cuisine, is actually, I mean, most of Ashkenazi Jews today or during the last century come from Poland and Russia, but the dishes go all the way back to France, to Germany. Mm-hmm. Things like gefilte fish or chopped liver are not eaten by Poles or Russians, only by Jews.
It's interesting. I just had Joan Nathan on recently, and she talked about going and searching and researching the Jewish food in France and how many of those recipes, because that you France just said, went back so long ago.
Because Jews move around all the time, you know, and they take with them, it's always some kind of food in transition or cuisine in transition, being, you know, bearing heritage from the past, being influenced by whatever is around it. And in this respect, Israeli food is exactly that, because Israeli food today is a combination of local food, which in this case would be Arabic, Palestinian, you know, local terroir, local ingredients, and immigrant cuisine. Only instead of one, we have, I don't know, 30 or 40. It's, which is, for a food historian, by the way, or a food lover, it's paradise.
I can imagine. For example, well, talking about new Israeli cuisine, I mean, Israel as its country as it is today is a very new country. So to say
it's
that,
a very new
that it's new cuisine, I mean, it's all new.
I decided to call it new is because I wanted to focus on what happened over, let's say, last 20 years, during which we really experienced a food revolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to explain first that the first wave of immigrants were primarily Poland, Eastern Europeans, right?
Eastern
Polish
Europeans,
and
yes.
Russian.
Largely. There were other groups, but largely there were Poles and Russians. And frankly, they're not really interested in food, and they were definitely not interested in diaspora food. Furthermore, they wanted nothing to do with the diaspora. They want to create, you know, the ethos of a new Israeli. But this new Israeli would be a farmer. He would work the land. And so there was some connection, you know, to local produce, to attempt to emulate ancient, you know, Hebrew culture, going all the way to the Bible. And that's why they looked upon their Arab neighbors for inspiration, because in many ways, Arabs symbolized for them, embodied for them, you know, the Asian Hebrews because they stayed in the land for all this time.
So when, all right, so now we have this new land back to Israel, back to, you know, and founding of a new homeland. You talk about the melting pot. You talk about all these cuisines coming together.
Yeah.
How do they mesh?
Well, they mesh in the most, but first I should mention this was the beginning, you know, these first waves of immigration. The big and mixed waves arrived later in the 40s and the 50s, and then we had Jews coming really from the Middle East, from the Balkans, from all over the world, and we had this few dozens of cuisine. And they were mixing simply because, you know, the population was mixing.
Mm-hmm.
Most of Israelis are, you know, what we call mixed origin, you know, and it becomes more and more so. Most Israel, even if your father is Hungarian and your mother is Czech, there is still two different cuisines.
Right.
And of course, if your mother is Moroccan and your father is Polish. And this is what happens all the time. But you can say that largely the Sephardic cuisine, you know, the Middle Eastern cuisine, the Balkan cuisine, are much more dominant.
Sure,
because,
well, look where you're living. I mean, you know.
Exactly. And Ashkenazi cuisine, what is, again, recognized worldwide as Jewish cuisine, is much less pervasive. It's really...
So when, you know, when people think of Israeli cuisine, the first thing they think of, those of us who aren't familiar with it, of course, hummus and falafel.
Both Arabic foods, both very popular. Hummus is, you know, local. I always say hummus is local religion. It's like cult food. And
it's like New York and hot dogs on the street. You know?
Something
it's
like that, or pizza. I don't know. But you must understand, hummus in Israel, it's like soccer in, you know, in England. There are fan clubs and there are websites and people would argue very heated. Exactly, who has the best. And I know that nowhere in the Middle East hummus enjoys such a, you know, such a status. I've just recently met with the owner of this wonderful restaurant, Ilili, Lebanese restaurant, and I asked him about the, you know, what hummus means in Lebanese cuisine. He said, well, it's a very good way to know if a cook knows his job, because like hummus and tabbouleh are the two dishes that you can learn about the, you know, the ability of the chef.
If they can't do that right, they can't
exactly
do
like
right.
Tomato sauce in Italian
yes.
cooking, but it's a part of mezze table, nothing more. Nobody goes out to have hummus. Nobody makes big deal of it.
Mm-hmm.
Israelis, it's like they swear by that. It's amazing. And falafel is another symbol that is sort of, it's there, but there are many, many more other, you know, more interesting dishes. Most of them Jewish, by the way, coming from, as I said, from immigrants.
From the immigrants, right.
Exactly.
Well, so we're going to talk about new dishes and the new influences after we take a short break. So we'll stay with us.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to The Main Course Sundays at 12 p.m. with hosts Patrick Martins and Katie Kiefer. They examine issues from the interconnected worlds of agriculture, cuisine, and sustainability. They sit down with key players in the chain from producer to consumer, farmers, distributors, chefs, activists, and journalists. The Main Course explores every important component of the eating experience, how the farmers raise their product, the distribution channels that move the product, how the chefs prepare it, and how ethics and policy affect everyone involved. Again, that's The Main Course, Sundays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Okay, we're back with John Moore, the author of Book of New Israeli Food, A Culinary Journey. And we were talking about, of course, Israeli food not being all that old anyway, but it is, because it is a conglomeration of all of these different cultures coming together in one place and forming a cuisine, if you will, old dishes with a new bent, you know, with a new twist to them. In your opinion, what are the important elements of Israeli cuisine?
Well, beside the, you know, this combination of local terroir and immigrant influences or Jewish ethnic influences, I would say the most important thing in Israeli cuisine are vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is what we do best. It's, you know, we have very good agriculture. We have abundance of fresh vegetables throughout the years. And I think that's what Israeli chefs excel at. Vegetables. Basically, I know this is an expression I borrowed from an article I read in an Indian newspaper about Israeli food, and they said, well, we Indians think that we know about vegetables. Now think again.
Huh.
Israelis really know how to do it because we cook them to death. They eat it fresh. And she said that one word that describes best Israeli cuisine is fresh, and I would add in all its meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Fresh as an impudent, fresh as some other journalists describe it, provocatively stylish. And this is true about we like bold flavors, we like fresh herbs, we like fresh vegetables, not so much sweet and sour, but more sweet and a little bit spicy and salty, olive oil, lemon juice, garlic. Fresh, Mediterranean, simple, generous helpings. You know, we are impatient people. People like sharing. You know, I think one of the most Israeli things is not necessarily a specific dish, which there are a few that I can mention, but the way we eat. I mean, sharing plates and having lots of food and cooking all the time. I think one of the things that makes Israeli food scene so special is that we do actually cook
it. Yeah.
And you know, the country is so small, so even when your kids leave home, luckily they stay, you know, within 1 hour drive. Mm-hmm. And they come back for the Friday night dinner, which is a mandatory institution. Right. Well, regardless of the factor whether you are an observant Jew or not, you're there for Friday night, and it has to be cooked from scratch. And on Friday night table, because as I said, you know, they're mixed origins, so you would see couscous for the main course and chicken soup, you know, as a soup, and then some cake, which is probably from Eastern Europe, because most of our cakes are sort of Austrian German origin, because most of the first bakers came from Germany. Right. And Austria. And so this is very family style, informal, casual, but yet, and this is the product of last, let's say, 15 to 20 years, the Western cooking improved tremendously.
Yes, yeah.
And that happened when chefs when first of all food became fine dining, became legitimate, and you know, because before that we're too busy surviving and building
right.
our country
and travel. I mean, travel was so much more
exactly
accessible.
People yeah. started to travel, becoming a chef or you know, choosing cooking as a career became legitimate. Chefs or young people would go abroad to study, and they would come back and they would try to apply what they learned on, you know, to local
well,
ingredients.
And that's international. I mean, that
happens everywhere.
A boom in that.
Exactly. And in Israel, it just happened very, very quickly and very, very dramatically. And that's what's so interesting about it. And this is what I try to convey.
And
in
certainly
my book.
We're seeing a lot of trendy new restaurants and dishes. And but I had to laugh because the very first line in your book, you write, they say nobody comes to Israel for the food.
Exactly.
Well, with this book, you're definitely trying to change
thing
things.
The thing is that probably if I have, the book was written 3 years ago and came out in the States 2 years ago, but today I probably wouldn't have said that because people are going to Israel for the food. Mm-hmm. The reason I said that is because Israel has so many more famous things, you know, like history and religion and everything.
Right, and people go,
but people do
reason.
Go to Israel for the food. There are culinary tours, some of them I'm involved with, others I just know about. People are going to Israel for the food, which is for me pretty incredible. But when they, even if they don't go to Israel for the food and they love food, they come to Israel and they're having a feast.
Mm. Well, I just loved reading through a lot of the recipes, and as you said, the freshness of
yeah.
the vegetables, the pictures, I mean, they really do show that freshness of there's like you know, moisture is bursting out of the tomatoes. But I got a sense. I was reading some of the recipes and knowing Italian cuisine very well. I'm thinking, wait a minute, this sounds very familiar. Well, it's all the Mediterranean. There are very similar dishes.
There are very similar.
You know, like the bread, the tomato bread soup, which is like a panzanella salad.
Yeah. Which is fattoush, by the way. It's Lebanese salad.
It's fattoush and it's panzanella in Italian.
It's very
similar.
You just
change a few of the herbs and you have the same thing. And just so many of the dishes, just using all the fresh ingredients from the land. And that's very
and
important.
What's nice about it that we're progressively getting more and more Mediterranean. I'll give you one example. Olive oil. Israel, you know, the symbol of the state of Israel is olive branch. Olive oil and olives are all over the Bible. And it's like the symbol of our culture. And yet, 25 years ago, we hardly used any olive oil in our cooking. Arab Israelis did, of course. Mm-hmm. Moroccan Jews, a little bit because they knew it from their old country. But most of the Israelis didn't know the first thing about the olive oil, maybe sprinkle a little bit of olive oil on their salad.
At the end.
And it took Mediterranean diet for us to pay attention to the fact that we have all this, you know, amazing olives growing all over the country. And now we consume so much olive oil that we have to import it. Import it. Because
right.
we don't have enough.
Yeah, right.
Which is quite amazing. And that's true for many ingredients. Even our music is, you know, becoming more and more Mediterranean. It's part of becoming part of, you know, actually where we live.
The whole cultural...
Exactly.
Zeitgeist, if you will. You now talk about some of the trendier dishes and not trendy, I mean, they're old dishes, but they're sort of brought to life again.
I can give you example of the eggplant. I think it's
there was one picture that where it's just roasted and split open.
Exactly. That's a really good example because basically eggplant, again, we didn't invent eggplant. It's like the soul of the Mediterranean. By the way, one of the names I toyed with when I thought about the name for the book was His Majesty the Eggplant, because he's like, you know, the king of vegetables for us. And it can be prepared, of course, it can be grilled, it can be fried. We prefer it, of course, grilled over open fire. And then you can do something very classic with that. You can prepare baba ganoush. And of course, again, we didn't invent baba ganoush. It's a classic Lebanese, Turkish part of the meze table. But what Israeli chefs do, by the way, I think the first to do it is Erez Komarovsky, who coming shortly to New York, this wonderful chef, he did what I called baba ganoush deconstructed. He took the whole grilled eggplant, slit it open, and poured tahini and olive oil and lemon juice and sprinkled some
herbs.
Today it's almost a cliche in Israeli, you know, in trendy Israeli restaurants. But when it first started, we were so, you know, excited about it. How can you take something so traditional and reinterpret it? One of the recent projects of Erez is, which we featured in our magazine, he took kugel, you know, the good old Jewish kugel, but he made it with lamb and with saffron and with courgette flowers. So the idea of noodle pies, you know, sitting all night in the oven is the same, but what you put in this noodle pie, what kind of noodles and what kind of condiments, what kind of ingredients is completely new.
It changes the whole
idea. And
we
are so lucky because we have so much to play with. I mean, we can take Iraqi recipe, Persian recipe, Yemenite recipe, and frankly, I think one of the things that disappoints me, that to my taste, Israeli chefs do not take enough of these goodies that surround us. Yesterday, I had a discussion with owners of lovely Israeli restaurant in New York, Taboon, and the owner is from Persia. I mean, she's a Persian Jew, and one of the most amazing Jewish Persian dishes is called gondi or gondi. It's a soup. It's a broth with something that looks like knedlach on steroids. Mm-hmm. It's like it's big,
it's a huge but once bowl in
you,
the center,
exactly.
Right.
But once you taste it, you discover it's something completely different. It's made from chickpea flour and chicken meat, and it's spiced with cardamom, and it's completely exotic and wonderful. And I ask, why don't you make it, you know, why don't you put it on the menu? It's such an amazing dish. I'm sure everybody will love it. But that's in New York. But you don't see much gondi in Tel Aviv as well.
You do say there is a Persian restaurant that I founded in New York where it's on the menu, actually.
I'm not sure. Gondi is on the menu?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I agree with you. I mean, it's one of those homey meals that it's just surprising.
And you don't expect this sort of, I don't know, festive flavors.
Right.
It's just so wonderful.
Right. How much... does kibbutz life play in the food or the evolution of the food in
kibbutz
Israel?
Was very important in the early history of Israel for food. I mean, kibbutz is credited with the invention of the Israeli breakfast, which is, we're very proud of it. And what makes Israeli breakfast Israeli is the fact that we have salad for breakfast. This is like very unique thing that probably nobody else does except Israelis having salad for breakfast. That's how I spot tourists, by the way, in Israel.
What they're eating for
breakfast.
They're
pushing away the salad. But it started on the kibbutz, because on the kibbutz there were, the farmers would go to the fields very early, and when they come back and to have their breakfast, quite hungry by then, they would make their own meal with whatever was available in the kitchen, and usually there were fresh vegetables. The salad itself is, again, it's Arabic. It's Middle Eastern chopped salad of cucumbers and tomatoes and onions. It's dressed with olive oil and lemon juice, but the use of this salad as a part of breakfast table is very uniquely Israeli. And so kibbutz, I wouldn't say beyond the breakfast thing that kibbutz was very influential, because on a kibbutz, it was, as I said before, I mean, fine dining was something almost frivolous. Mm-hmm. On a kibbutz, I mean, you produced, you grew oranges.
Farm,
and you,
farm food.
It's farm
eating.
Food, yeah. But you never made a big deal of it. But, you know, there is one interesting story about the kibbutz and gastronomy. Cake baking. Cake baking, very big in Israel. And on a kibbutz, there were no private kitchens. You know, there was this communal dining hall. And yet there were women who wanted to express their culinary creativity, and they would make the cake in their homes and take it to the communal kitchen to be baked. And they, because, you know, you always bake for weekends, you bake for Friday night, so you'll have something to serve for dessert or to give your guests, because in Israel, when you invite people over, it's for a cake and coffee. That's the standard thing. And so much so that there were even cookbooks published based on these recipes from kibbutzim during the time that there were no kitchens, but they still baked cakes.
That's interesting.
So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. You do include in the book a section on wine. In fact, you say, wine fever in the Holy Land.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's because kosher wine, of course, we, you know, for so many years now, of course, we can find wonderful kosher wines.
First of all, it's a very important thing to know that kosher wine is exactly the same as non-kosher wine. It has to be, according to Jewish religious laws, it had to be made by observant Jews. That's
right.
All.
Right.
I mean, the same wine. It's not better, it's not worse. It could be anything. It could be anything from great to substandard. And in fact, if, again, you know, this sentence that I repeat all over again in the book, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, we didn't have that great coffee, we didn't have great bread, we didn't have
great wine.
Great wine. We had Israeli wine was, we called it hammer wine because it gives you headache. Yain patishim in Hebrew. And then about 25 years ago, with the advent of Yarden Winery on the Golan Heights, it all changed. They were the first to change the scene of local wines. They modeled their winery after California wineries. And today, I think Israeli wine scene is quite amazing. We have over 200 boutique wineries, about 20 or 30 large wineries. In terms of quantity, you know, the volume, it's still very, very small production. But there is variety. There is an ongoing attempt to locate or to define terroirs. And we now realize that wines that come from, for example, from Jerusalem Mountains or Judean Hills, what we call, is quite different from the ones that comes from the Galilee. It's more elegant, it's
so
less
fruity.
Yeah.
So you are developing.
And we
this.
Even are growing wine in the desert, which is really a cool thing.
Huh. Well, it's interesting because I know that so many of the markets are the major gathering places. I mean, market food, and there are now restaurants that are springing up in these markets too, that are some of the better known and better restaurants.
It's interesting with the markets. Markets is open. I mean, food markets are something very romantic. We all want to shop at the markets, and we usually do that in supermarkets because there is, you know, parking lots and air conditioning, and they accept credit cards. And so there was for a while, even certain deterioration in local food markets. And now we have like a new burst of life coming with these restaurants and little bistros and bars opening in the middle, as you said, in the middle of the market, at least one in Tel Aviv, the leading market in Tel Aviv called the Carmel Market, and in Jerusalem called Machne Yehuda Market. And they like have a different clientele now. So people still shop there for vegetables, but they would come also and have a cup of coffee and have a nice meal based on the produce on the market. So they're becoming a little bit like tourist place, but in a good way, I would say, for local tourists.
Yeah.
And we also have, by the way, and this is very, very new, we have farmers markets.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it started like, because, well, it's not that necessary to have farmers market in Israel because, but it is different because at the general market, you're buying from a wholesaler.
But everything is local anyway, so.
Yes, but still, if you buy from, to quote Michael Pollan, to look in with the eyes of someone who grew your food,
yes,
and to talk with him or her about it. And we even have a very miniature version of something that looks like Chelsea Market now in the Tel Aviv port with wonderful producers and cheesemakers and artisanal bread makers.
So it just makes you think more about what you're eating, as you say, like Michael Pollan says. I mean, just you take your food more. Yeah, not that we should take it too seriously as food, but I mean, but what you put in your body should be very important to you.
Yeah. And you know, in this respect, we're in a good place in Israel because, as I said before, we are a cooking nation. People love to cook. People are very proud of their, culinary heritage. And even though we have a lot of, fast food coming in, and yet, if you ask, I think most of Israelis, what they would rather have, a good portion of shawarma, which is good food, basically,
yeah, sure,
that or McDonald's.
So don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, they say.
Yeah.
So, keep some of those old things.
Yes, it's made on the, it's freshly made. It's nice. It's flavorful. They would say, shawarma or maybe burekas or falafel rather than McDonald's or any kind of, commercial fast food.
So what would you really say is, if you could sum up, what is new? What is really
new? Is, first of all, legitimacy of, engaging in fine dining, creativity of the chefs, the fusion that is becoming more and more intense. It's a baby cuisine. I mean, it's too early. That's why I'd never called it the Book of New Israeli Cuisine, because it's not a cuisine yet. It's too early. The freshness, the healthiness, the variety. The fact that we can have even, street food, forget about restaurants. You can have like 10 or 12 or 15 different kinds of street foods, all of them local. Burekas and shawarma and something called sabich, which is actually based on an Iraqi Shabbat morning sandwich, and et cetera, et cetera. And also pizza and great cakes. So there is a lot going on. And also the fact that, as I said, we had this revolution over the last 20 years, so the ingredients became much better. We have wonderful bread and cheese and wine and all the basic stuff that you need to have. Even though chefs complain that we don't have enough great seafood, and and it's true, there are still things that are difficult to find, but all in all, it's great and dynamic and unique. And coffee is amazing. Israeli coffee is amazing.
I mean,
really.
you can almost smell it looking through the pages. You said somewhere in the book, you said that in fewer than 30 years, Israeli society has graduated to a true gastronomic haven.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly hearing you and your enthusiasm and your passion for this food and then reading the book and looking through the wonderful recipes, and again, I say, and those wonderful photographs, you're doing it justice, for sure.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We're very fortunate today to also have with us Nama Sheffi, and Nama is she is the project manager from the Department of Public Affairs of the Consulate General of Israel. And Nama, welcome.
Thank you, Linda. It's great to be here.
You are a real champion of this new Israeli cuisine too, because you were the first one to talk to me about it and encourage me to meet Jana, and I thank you so much for that.
Yeah,
so you have planned a very nice, it's been like a whole week of activities and
2 months. Actually.
2 months, 2 months of activities. Can you tell us a little bit about the activities that are here in New York to introduce people to new Israeli cuisine?
Sure, absolutely. So we are very proud to have Jana Gor with us, and we had two events with her already. Last Monday, we have Jana speaking at the New York Public Library, and it was really an amazing event. And we had Jana talking with John Nathan at the James Beard Foundation pop-up project at the Chelsea Market.
Pop-up restaurant, yes.
Yes, mm-hmm. And that was also quite unique and interesting. And coming up, we have Chef Erez Komorowski, which Jana mentioned before, and we will have Erez cook at the James Beard Foundation in June 4th. And that
June
be
4th, okay.
Right.
If there's still spaces available, check that out, the James Beard
Absolutely.
Foundation, June 4th.
It's going to be delicious.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm sure.
And then you are going to be giving a presentation at the 92nd Street Y
right.
coming up soon. Right,
right, with Francine Sagan. And I will give an update of the current culinary scene, more, you know, specifically talking about different restaurants in Israel and Jerusalem and small secret places, coffee shops, stuff like that.
Well, it's all very exciting. And I know who I'm going to contact for my gastronomic tour of Israel. So, Jana and Nama, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you very much.
Again, this has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm Linda Palacio. Please join us again for another journey through culinary history.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This little nugget comes from Food Safety News, which is a blog that you can get every single day if you want to sign up for it. I love it. And in this one, it says, in what qualifies as ground-shifting news in the food safety world, the U.S. Department of Agriculture today, on Tuesday, lopped 15 degrees off of its recommended temperature for safely cooking whole cuts of pork, aligning it with guidelines already in place for beef, veal, and lamb. Heating steak, roasts, and chops to an internal temperature of 145 degrees Fahrenheit, so long as the meat sits briefly before it's eaten, is enough to ensure its safety, the USDA said. This latest revision for pork comes again on the advice of the FSIS, which is the Food Safety Inspection Service, which says cooking cuts of pork to 145 degree Fahrenheit with a 3-minute rest is as safe as cooking them to 160 degrees, the previously recommended temperature with no rest time. So now you can have a little bit of pink, juicy pork, even if you're buying commodity pork, which should vastly improve its taste and eating quality. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat. Nicole Taylor is always the first to talk with new and exciting personalities in the food world on her show, Hot Grease. Check out a little clip.
Everything is super sweet in the Heritage Radio Network studios today. We're chatting with Fanny Gerson. Fanny is a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America and the 2011 James Beard Foundation Cookbook Award nominee. Oh my God, we fry in Bed-Stuy. We have to talk dough. donuts. I'm going to have to say, Fanny, I don't know if you know this. I was definitely the first person in Brooklyn to start talking about it, though. Did you know that?
I knew that last time I saw you.
Ah.
But I didn't know that before.
So we have to talk dough. I mean, it is a bona fide phenomenon in Brooklyn.
I'm so excited to be part of it. I can't believe it.
You know? I mean, I was just telling you before the show that I think about a month ago, I went to dough on a Sunday at 2 o'clock and all the donuts
you like
were
what
gone.
You hear? You can hear Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. live on heritageradionetwork.com. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast or check it out in our archives.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.